tonight is something that is relevant to Hanukkah and is something that is relevant throughout the year. And we're going to frame our discussion by saying the following. The Chassam Sofer lived in the end of the 1700s, one of the great Gedolim in Europe. He was the Av Bezdin in Presburg. The Chassam Sofer writes in one of his tshuvas, Kol yamai ha'yisi mitztar al ha'mikra hazeh. The Chassam Sofer writes, I was in agony my entire life over a specific pasuk that I didn't believe that I really had the ability to perform properly. So the Chassam Sofer says, I'm obligated to keep Shabbos, I can do it to the best of my ability. I'm obligated to do many different things, I can do it as best as I can. But he says there's one mitzvah that I came across that I just don't know how I can possibly fulfill properly. And that is the mitzvah of V'yisem Nekiyim Mehashem Yisrael. That is the mitzvah of Chashad and Maris Ayin, making sure that I live life so above board that nobody will ever accuse me of doing something wrong. Said the Chassam Sofer, how is that possible? I don't understand. If God asks me, if the Ribbono Shel Olam instructs me to do a particular mitzvah, and to do it a certain way, and to shake lulav, and to sit in the sukkah, and to blow the shofar, I can do all those mitzvahs. But how can I do something? How can I live my life in a way that nobody else is going to look at me in a negative perspective? How can I possibly be held to such a standard? What can I do to make sure that people's imaginations aren't going to roam and think negatively about something that I might be doing? And therefore, Sedech Samsofer, in his opinion, he believed this really is the most difficult mitzvah in all of the Taryag mitzvahs, which is an amazing insight of the Chassam Sofer. And he says that this perhaps is what it means when we say, Shlomo HaMelech teaches us that Adamein Tzadik Baretz Asher Yasa Tova Lo Yechta. There is no such thing as a person going through all of life without ever violating an Avera. Said the Chassam Sofer, what do you mean? You never have a Tzadik who lives his whole life being such a sincere person that they never violate an Avera? Writes the Chassam Sofer, this perhaps is what it's referring to. There is nobody who has ever lived through the entire experience in this world without violating at least this one avera of chashad and maris ha'ayin. Because how can I be responsible for what other people are going to think or say about me? It's impossible for me to live a life where somebody out there is not going to think negatively about something that I've done. And therefore writes the Chassam Sofer, he believes this is something that is very difficult, and that's what I'd like to talk about tonight because it's very relevant to Hilchos Chanukah. How do we define, how do we understand, how do we appreciate this halacha of chashad and maris ayin and its relevance to us? So the first question one always needs to ask whenever thinking about any halachic topic or any discussion is, are we dealing with a halacha that is an isur d'oraisa or perhaps something which is only in isur midrabbanan? Every time the Prima Gadam introduces any halacha in Hilchos Shabbos or anywhere in Orach Chaim, the Prima Gadam always says first, we'll bring 10 rayas that is d'oraisa, 10 rayas is d'rabbanan, but the bottom line is you always have to know, are we dealing with something that's d'oraisa, d'rabbanan, for the simple reason that safek d'oraisa l'chumra, safek d'rabbanan l'kula, makes a big difference. And not always is everything so clear, so we really have to define what it is. So we look at the Mishnah Maseches Shkalim, which is the first on the source sheet, where the Mishnah tells us, Hanichnas litrom es halishka, when you have the treasurer, when you have the manager of the Beis HaMikdash, who comes into the Beis HaMikdash in order to take care of the money that was dedicated to the cause of the Beis HaMikdash. So we're told there, Eino nichnas lo b'manol, v'lo b'sando, v'lo b'tfilin. He's not allowed to come into the Beis HaMikdash with his shoes. He cannot wear his tfilin. He's not allowed to wear his slippers. He can't wear anything. Why? Shemi yechashdu bo shekanav mimos halishka. Because maybe somebody's going to say that he hid some money in his shoes, or he hid some money in his pockets of his pants. Now, to say that maybe he hid money in his tefillin? Who are we talking about? Do we think that Kohen Gadol would really, or whoever was the one who we singled out, we probably would have chosen somebody who is the most trustworthy person hanging around the Beis HaMikdash to be the one to be Torah Mesalishka. Who else is going to be the treasurer of a shul? We're not going to have somebody who we don't trust, we're going to have somebody we do trust. And if that's the case, well, sometimes we're surprised and they do something they shouldn't do, but normally we're going to choose somebody who really is worthy of the job. And yet the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, we don't want that there should be anybody who's going to say anything. And therefore, we have to make sure he takes off anything that might possibly make anybody feel that he's doing something wrong. So much so that he even has to remove his tefillin because we don't want anyone talking. Says the Mishnah, Shenemar, because we learn from a pasuk, V'yisem nekiyem mehashem umeyisrael, V'omer, and it also says, V'nimtzachein v'seichel tov be'enei elokim ve'adam. So this is what the Gemara says, and from here we learn the halacha of Chashad and Maris Ha'ayin. We have a Gemara in Yevamos as well, where the Gemara tells us, Mipnei Ma Amra Torah. Why does the Torah say that you have to leave Peah B'sof Sadeh? We know that you have to leave over one corner of your field, but why can't I leave over the corner that's on all the way in the other side of the field where nobody's going to walk by? It's also a peah of my field. Mipnei ma amra Torah, asked the Gemara, that you have to leave it over b'sof sadeyu, at the side of the field where everybody's going to notice it, because we don't want people to think that you didn't perform the mitzvah of peah. And therefore we're told that you have to specifically leave it over in a place where everybody's going to see it. Everybody's going to notice it. So, from the fact that Gemara uses the terminology b'pnei ma amra Torah, why does the Torah say that you have to leave it over b'sof sadeyu? It would seem to be an indication that we're dealing with an issa d'oraisa, not only an issa d'rabbanan. And yet, very surprisingly, the Rush writes in Maseches Beitza that this whole idea of chashad ha'marasayin is something that is only mid'rabbanan. And therefore, writes the Rush, whenever a person has a suffix about chashad ha'marasayin, we have a right to say suffix l'kula. Now, this is a very important thing to be aware of in general in halacha. When we say that suffix d'rabbanan l'kula, that doesn't mean if I don't know the halacha because I happen not to be learned, so therefore it's a suffix so I can be mekel because it's only an issa d'rabbanan. Let's say you have a lot of halachas on Shabbos. The halachas of muktzah, very complicated. Who really knows the laws of muktzah? Most people don't. So you'll say, oh, it's a suffix anyway, because I'm not sure, and it's only nisa d'rabbanan, so I may as well touch the thing anyway, I may as well move it, I may as well handle it, because suffix d'rabbanan l'kula. No, that's not what the principle means. Suffix d'rabbanan l'kula means when I have a suffix in halacha, when it's a sveika d'dina, I really don't know what the status of this item is. I don't really know. The halacha itself is not sure how to handle this, so then we say safek d'rabbanan l'kula. Or extenuating circumstances, you can say shas adchak remekel. However, when we're dealing with something where I'm just misinformed, or I just simply am uninformed, I don't know anything, in a case like that we say that is not safek d'rabbanan l'kula. That's not what we mean here. So we have to educate ourselves on what it means, chashad ha'marasayin, and where it applies and where perhaps it does not. Rashi writes two different definitions in two different mesechtas. In one place, Rashi in Avodah Zarah daf Yud-Beis. Anybody else cold? So in one place, Rashi writes in Maseches Avodah Zarah Daf Yud-Beis that the reason why you're not allowed to do something that's going to make other people think negatively is because Shema Yechashdu B'nei Adam, because maybe people are going to accuse you. People are going to talk negatively about you, and that's the reason why you cannot do anything that will make them think negatively. Rashi in Maseches Krisos writes a different reason, and he says, Shema yilmedu mimenu. Maybe they'll learn from you and they will do the same. Now, they don't realize that the only reason you were doing what you were doing is because you were under a certain set of circumstances and that's why you were doing something that was mutter for you to do. But if you're doing something that's ambiguous, that's not so clear, Rashi writes in Maseches Krisos, we don't only have to be concerned that maybe people are going to talk negatively about you, we also have to be concerned that they are going to learn from you. Now, Rav Soloveitchik said for that first Rashi, why do I care if people talk negatively about me? What's it my business? Let them say whatever they want. I'm happy to be the person who I am. I'm very comfortable. Let them say what I want. If anybody here ever goes into the rabbinate, you'll learn. People will say things about you, whether you do the right thing or the wrong thing. Doesn't make a difference how hard you try. People are always going to talk negatively about you. And at a certain point, you have to say, I just don't care. Because if you care, it just eats you up alive. So what do I care? Rav Soloveitchik said, what in the world do I care what people have to say about me? Let them say what they want. And Rav Soloveitchik answered that the problem here is that people believe that their reputations belong to them. And therefore they say, what do I care what people say? But he said that's a big mistake. My reputation does not belong to me. I'm in Tzelem Elokim, and that means I represent the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if people think negatively about me, it means that reflects negatively on the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So I don't have a right to make a conscious decision that I'm going to do something that's going to make people think in a negative way about me, because after all, it's not a decision that's really in my hands. When it's something that's only impacting me, myself, and nobody else, I can make a decision like that. But when it's something that's impacting my reputation, that is something that is not only in my control, and it's not something that only stops with me. It's something that reflects negatively on my community, on my family, on the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. And therefore we assume that reputation is something that is very, very important. Certainly today, when people's reputations are being destroyed, we should be careful that our reputation should be to the highest of standards. So, one very important question that is discussed in Shulchan Aruch is, do we assume that Chashad and Maaris Ayin applies only to Isurim D'Oraisa, when someone's going to accuse me of doing something wrong, which is an Issa D'Oraisa, or even if someone is going to accuse me for violating an Issur Midrabbanan? Now, if I would ask anybody, I would believe. If I would ask anyone, what is the answer to that question without knowing any sources, what would you say? What's the most logical answer? Why should it make a difference? What does it matter if people are going to think that I'm violating an issa d'oraisa or violating an issa d'rabbanan? Either way, they're going to say, shechta the bum. He goes and he claims he's the rabbi. Meanwhile, I saw him violating the Avera. Oh, it was only the rabbi. Doesn't matter. He claims that he's so, he's the rabbi. What's he doing? So what does it matter if it's an Issa Daraisa Derabbanan, they're going to be choshen before? Either way, someone's going to say he's not following the law that he's supposed to be following. So this is, in fact, a machlokis between the Rama and the Shach. It's a very important machlokis, which begins as follows. We have a Gemara Maseches Ksubas on Daf Samach, where the Gemara says, Chalav Mahalchei Arba is kosher. When you have milk that comes from an animal, so we assume many of those milks are kosher as long as they come from a kosher animal. However, says the Gemara, when you have Chalav Mahalchei Shtayim, when you have milk that comes from a human being, there it's not so clear. So when you have a woman's milk, the Gemara says, if it's extracted from the body and now it's in a cup or in a pitcher, so then we say that's kosher milk, everyone's allowed to eat it. However, for an adult to go and nurse directly from the woman, we say that's something that's inappropriate and that is something that is not supposed to be done at all. Now, the Ramban has a very troubling issue with this Gemara, and he says, don't we have an issur of Eiver Min Achai? Don't we have an issur that you're not allowed to eat an animal while it's still alive? Right? You have to shecht it first. And therefore, writes the Ramban, I would assume that the same way you're not allowed to eat an animal while it's alive, you're certainly not allowed to eat Besar Adam. Certainly not allowed to violate the prohibition of cannibalism. Who would be allowed to eat human flesh? So if human flesh is not allowed to be consumed, then anything that's a derivative of human flesh also shouldn't be allowed to be consumed. Ask the Ramban, so then how are we allowed to eat human milk? Shouldn't that be something that is an extract from something that is prohibited? And the Gemara writes in Mechorah on Daf Vav that Hayotze min HaTameh, Tameh, anything that is the extract from something which is prohibited is also prohibited. So if you have a pig, we don't say only the pig is usur, we say even the milk of a pig is usur. And the same goes for many other things. So then why is it that you're allowed to consume human milk? That's the kasha of the Ramban, and he gets into the whole discussion with the Rambam, exactly how to understand the issur of eating Besar Adam. But either way, the Rashba poses the following question. So we have a Gemara here where we're told that you're allowed to consume human milk. As long as it's not directly from the woman's body, you're allowed to have it once it's extracted. Ask the Rashba, number Beis. Ocha Alta, Basar B'chalav Ishamahu. So am I allowed to cook this human milk together with meat? After all, what are you going to say? It's milchix? What is it? What's the status of the milk? It's kosher, the Gemara says, but is it milchix? It's not milchix, it's parf. So are you allowed to cook this milk with meat? Says the Rashba, Kivin Shechalav Ishach HaShapirish Mutterim Kein Embas HaYisr Klal. Would you say there's no problem at all because after all, the milk is parev, the meat is fleishig, and there's no problem to cook them? Or, says the Rashba, maybe you'll say that it's us or Mishum Maris Ayin. Maybe you'll say it's not allowed because somebody who walks by my window and sees that I'm pouring a bottle of milk into the chalin, they're going to say, how can he do such a thing? They don't know that that happens to be the human milk that we were storing in the fridge. So they don't know that. And therefore, writes the Rashba, maybe we have to be concerned about Maris Ayin. And the Rama comes to the conclusion, like the Rashba writes, the Ramah writes very famously in Siman Pei Zayin that you're not allowed to cook Chalav Isha with Basar because we're concerned of Maris Ayin. Even though you know that you're doing something permissible and you're not going to make the mistake, but perhaps somebody who's noticing from the outside is going to confuse that what you're doing and you're going to do something and you're going to lead to an issue of Maris Ayin. Now the Ramah extends the case a little bit further and he says, okay, what about when you have Chalav Shkedim? What about when you have chalav shkedim? So you have milk that comes not from a human being and not from an animal, but rather you have milk that comes from nuts, milk that comes from almonds. So, right, shkedim is almonds. How's everyone looking at me? So shkedim is almonds. So the Rama writes, the same isser should apply when you have chalav shkedim. The same way you're not allowed to cook meat with human milk because of Maris Ayin, you shouldn't be allowed to cook chalav shkedim, nut milk, with meat either because we have to be concerned of Maris Ayin. However, says the Rama, the only time we have to be concerned is when you're cooking actual meat with actual milk that comes from these nuts. However, if all you're going to be cooking is chicken, you don't have to be concerned. Why not? What's the difference between chicken and meat? Answers the Rama, because the only prohibition midaraisa basar b'chalav is when you cook real milk and real meat. So now, you have real milk and real meat, that's the Issa D'Oraisa. Knock it down one level, you're going to have fake milk and real meat. So what is that? Totally mutter, it's only a problem of Maris Ayin. What if you knock it down two levels? You have fake milk and fake meat. You have chicken and fake milk. So what is that? Nothing. It's twice removed. And therefore, writes the Ramah, at worst, all you're going to violate is an Issa D'Rabbanan, because to cook real milk together with chicken is only an Issa D'Rabbanan. So he says, what's someone going to say? At worst, they're going to say, you violated an Issa D'Rabbanan. Says the Ramah, you don't have to worry about that. Marasai doesn't apply when someone's only going to think that you violated an Issa D'Rabbanan. And the Shach jumps on him and he says, how can he say such a thing? What does that mean? If the whole prohibition of Maris Ayin is that someone's going to think negatively or learn something negative from that which you have done, why should it make a difference if you're violating something which looks like an Issa D'Oraisa or you're violating something which only looks like an Issa D'Rabbanan? Either way, there's a problem of Maris Ayin. Either way, we have to be concerned that maybe someone's going to walk away and think negatively about that which you have done. And that's where the Shach absolutely does not accept this concept that the Ramah introduces us to. Which leads us to an issue which is a very prevalent issue. What about dairy creamers today? So we have many times at a wedding, at the end of the wedding it's very late and people are exhausted and they serve coffee. And the question is, are you allowed to have the coffee with a dairy creamer? Now we all know that the dairy creamer is only a dairy creamer, it's not milk. But maybe somebody's going to see us pouring a white substance into the black coffee right at the end of a fleishiga wedding. So how are we allowed to do that? Isn't that a problem in Marasayin? This is a very big issue. So the Ramah says, well, as long as you have the nuts right next to the milk, that is the almond milk, as long as you have some of the nuts there, everybody's going to know that all you're using is chalav shkedim. They're going to realize it's obvious from the circumstance that you're not violating an avera. And so too over here. If you're going to have it in a container that is clearly demarcated as the coffee creamer and it's not milk, then perhaps there's room to be makel, but many of the kashrus agencies today are not so sure about this because, again, Marasayin is something that depends sometimes on the circumstance and sometimes on the scenario that you're dealing with. So now let's move to Hilchos Chanukah. We have a Gemara Maseches Shabbos, Daf Chaf Gimel, where the Gemara tells us, I forgot to put it on here, the Gemara says, Chatzer sheyeshla shnei psachim. When you have a home which has two psachim, so you have one person sees your house from this side, one person sees your house from the other side. So where are you supposed to light the Neres Chanukah? Answers the Gemara, you have to light in both places. Why? Because of Maris Ayin. Someone's going to pass by your house on that side of the street, and they're not going to know that you lit the menorah on the other side. They're going to say, oh look, Shechta didn't light menorah tonight. And therefore, says the Gemara, you have to light on both sides, Mishum Maris Ayin. So the Beis HaLevi asks such a great question. The Beis HaLevi has an issue in which he raises that, how can you say, in the Gemara we have a discussion whether Kavsa Zakukla or Kavsa Ein Zakukla. What does that mean? The Gemara has a machlokas whether if your candle goes out, do you have to relight it or not? How do we paskin? Once you lit the menorah, halakha osa mitzvah. So once you lit it, you did your mitzvah. And therefore, even if it goes out subsequently, you don't have to worry at all. You have performed your mitzvah, and you have to. You can just move on. No reason to light it again. Ask the Beis HaLevi, if we have a consideration here of Maris Ayin, don't you have to be concerned that somebody who walks by my house 5 minutes after this Zman Hadlaka sees my menorah there, with nothing lit, they're going to say, Shechta didn't light menorah tonight. They don't know that I lit and it went out 3 minutes later. So how can you tell me, Kavsa Ein Zakukla, if after all, shouldn't we be concerned that maybe someone's going to make a mistake and think that I didn't light menorah at all? How does the halacha make any sense? And therefore the Shari Tshuva writes that maybe the proper thing to do in such a case is that you have to leave the wicks there and the oil there. You can't just throw out the candle that blew out. You have to leave it there. And therefore, somebody who walks by is going to say, oh, Shechter must have lit the menorah, but it went out, and he didn't bother to light it again because of Kavsa Ein Zakukla, and it's evident that that's the case because I see that the candle's still there. Ask the Beis HaLevi, is that really true? It's pitch dark outside, and the lights are off in my house, so somebody's going to look so carefully at my house. We have people who are looking into our windows that carefully that they want to see how much oil is left, and did he really light it, and is there burnt wick at the top, or maybe it's still white? It's not really so feasible to imagine that people are going to do that. And therefore, writes the Beis HaLevi, he really doesn't understand how does this halacha kavsa ein zakukla fit in with the regular rules that we find by halachas haMenorah itself, which is that you have to be concerned of the people on both sides of the street, and therefore you have to light a menorah on both sides of the house because of Maris Ayin. How does that fit with this halacha of kavsa ein zakukla? I think it's a great question to think about. Either way, so when it comes to Hadlakas HaMenorah on one night of Chanukah, so the Gemara says, I light my menorah over here because that's where the Pursuma Nisa is going to be. However, I have neighbors on the other side of the street that are going to see the other side of my house. And therefore, the Gemara says, I have to light a second one, Mishum Maris Ayin. So the Ran very famously writes that when you light the second menorah on the other side of the house because of Maris Ayin, the Ran tells us, no bracha is required when you light the second menorah. Why? Because the mitzvah that I did really was by the first menorah. Why am I doing the second one? Not because the Torah says I have to light menorah twice, but rather because of Maris Ayin. So you don't make a bracha sher kedushan mitzvos v'tzivanu lehadlik ner shel Chanukah on the second one, because I'm not lighting this because of Ner Chanukah. I'm lighting it really because I have crazy neighbors who are going to think negatively about me. And therefore writes the Ran, and this is the Psak in Shulchan Aruch, that if somebody's lighting on the other side of the house, there's no reason to recite a bracha. It's very similar to what the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva. And that is when we have a katan hamasurba ol babasar. So that means we gave a young child a bris milah. And then it turns out that the kid is a very fatty child, and now it seems that the bris is no longer noticeable. I don't know, do we have such a thing today? Once in a while it happens. So it's no longer noticeable that a child has a bris milah. So the halach and Shulchan Aruch is, you have to do a bris milah once again. So the Chasam Sofer says, and now that you do the second bris milah, why are we doing the second bris milah? The kid's not an arel. He didn't grow back the arla. So why are we doing a bris again? Because of Maris Ayin. And who's looking at him? I don't know. But we have a concern of Maris Ayin. Someone's going to say the kid is an arel. Someday down the line, we don't want someone to say that. So we have to cut off the skin to make sure it's noticeable that he's not an arel. We have to make sure it's noticeable that he had a bris. So ask the Chasam Sofer. You're doing a bris now, not because of the mitzvah of bris milah, but rather because of Maris Ayin. So do you make a bracha on that second bris milah that you do? Right, Chasam Sofer, of course not. Why? Because the only time you say v'tzivanu ala milah is when you're performing the mitzvah of milah, which we did already, 8 days. Now what are you doing? All you're doing is a Maris Ayin milah. So a Maris Ayin milah is not the mitzvah itself. We don't make a bracha when it comes to a Maris Ayin. Now, this is all wonderful, but it's slightly problematic because we have a halacha that the Gemara in Chulin Daf Ayin Daled discusses, which is the institution of a ben pakua. Ben pakua means when you have a cow that is shechted, and at the time of the shechita there was a calf inside that wasn't yet born, and then after the shechita we discover that this calf is a fully developed calf and now is able to be eaten. So the Gemara says, really, it does not require a shechita, because we assume that the shechita sa'im, that the mother shechita works and is able to cover the child as well. So there's a guy in Australia who emails me very often, and he's a very he's going to be listening, and I appreciate his emails, and they're all great. And he has a very inquisitive mind, and he always comes up with great ideas. So he has a friend of his who had an idea: why don't we save lots of money on shechita by doing what? Why don't we have a ben pakua farm? Because if you have one ben pakua that marries another ben pakua, none of them really need shechita. So he says, this would be a great idea. Why don't we start a whole line of animals that are all going to be the children or the descendants of ben pakuas, and then nothing's going to need shechita at all. So the answer to that is, the Gemara says it really doesn't require a shechita kehalacha, but it does require a shechita midrabanan. So you don't have to follow all the chumras, so he's still correct. If we marry one ben pakua to another one, you can still rely on many, many kulas, which would cut down the cost of kosher meat, because he wouldn't have to go with all the chumras that we normally follow in regular hilchos shechita. So he has a great idea. Why don't we start this farm of ben pakua? He's been talking about it for a long time. I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. Maybe down there it has. But it's an interesting question. So the halacha is that when you have a ben pakua, it really does not require a shechita on its own. Why? Because we assume that the shechita that was done for the mother is sufficient for the child as well. However, says the Gemara, you have to be concerned, the Maris Ayin, what's going to happen? You have an animal roaming around your backyard. I happen to be the owner, and I know that that's the ben pakua. So I know it doesn't need a shechita, because even though it's walking around, it's as if it was already shechted. How that makes sense? Hard to understand, but that's the halacha. So therefore, what's going to happen? One fine day, I'm going to be roaming around in my backyard. I'm going to say, you know, I'd like to have a nice barbecue tonight. You just pull off an animal, you know, out of your backyard, and you just eat it. Someone's going to walk by and say, look at that. He eats the animal without doing a shechita. How could it be? So the Gemara says, because of a concern of Maris Ayin, therefore we need to do a shechita even for the ben pakua, which really shouldn't require a shechita at all. So that's the way the Gemara understands. Would you make a bracha on such a shechita? The answer should have been no. Why? Because the whole reason for the shechita is only because Maris Ayin. And over here, we had the halacha by Neris Chanukah, when you do a mitzvah only because of Maris Ayin, you don't make a bracha. And we spoke about by Bris Milah, when you do a Bris Milah only for Maris Ayin, like some sofer said, you don't make a bracha. All of a sudden, writes the Rashban and Tshuva, when it comes here to this halacha, to this inyan of Ben Pakua, we say, Ben Pakua, when you shecht it, because of Maris Ayin, it requires a bracha. Why is that? So some Achronim say it's a machlokas the Rashba and the Ran. Okay, that's always the easy answer to say this Rishon says you do make a brach on Marasayin, and this Rishon says you don't. So that's an answer that we don't like to rely on, or if we have a better answer to give. So this is a very important question, and it's fundamental to the issue of Marasayin to really figure out what is the story of Marasayin. When the Chazal instituted that we have to do something because of Marasayin, how far did they take that? And what does it mean now that we have an obligation to do a mitzvah because of Marasayin? Does that mean that now that Chazal told me this animal needs to be shechted, does it mean until the animal is shechted is considered to be a Efer Min Achai? Did the Chachamim say that this animal is Becheskas Iser until I shecht it? Because once we say Marasayin requires me to shecht it now, there's like an Iser on that animal. That's what some Achronim say. And that's why over there you have to make a bracha v'tzivanu ala shechita, because the animal takes on the properties of a Becheskas Iser. However, when you talk about, let's say, the mitzvah of Neiris Chanukah, or the mitzvah of a Bris Milah, those aren't comparable. What are you going to say? The child takes on a Cheskas Aro? How can you call him an Aro? We know it's not true. We know that it's not true. Chazal can't put onto a child a Cheskas Aro after he's already had a Bris Milah. Chazal can't put onto this house a Chazakah as if we haven't lit Chanukah candles yet, even though we already have on the other side. Just turn around the block and you'll see it. So therefore, perhaps there's room to distinguish between the case of Ben Pakua, where we say when you do that shechita, the Ramban, the Rashba tells us that you do need to do a shechita, and you do need to say a bracha. Whereas on the other hand, when you have Neiris Chanukah and some of the other cases that we mentioned, one perhaps would not have to recite a bracha because that mitzvah is only being done l'shem Marasayin. It's time for Maravasi, but in mitzvah Shem, we will continue with something else next week, unless people want to continue about this. I don't know. Probably not.